As many of you know, Carolyn and I used to live in Milton Keynes, and one day, driving through Milton Keynes, I found myself behind a bus. And on the back of the buses in Milton Keynes, as probably they do around here, they used to put adverts on the back of them for various companies and things like that. So I'm driving slowly behind a bus, and on the back of this bus is an advert for a local solicitor's firm. And it says in big, bold letters, "Divorce is our specialty." Now I share that story with couples who meet with me for marriage preparation. I always I encourage, and actually I try to insist, that couples meet 3 or 4 times to talk about what they're going to be doing. And it's surprising how often people are resistant to this. They want to focus on the day, they want to have a good day, and we can give them a very special day. But actually, you know, I share this story because I think one of the responsibilities we have as ministers and as a church is to help people build enduring relationships. That is our specialty. That's our specialty. And I don't want to just give people a good day. I want to give people some guidance and things which will help them navigate the days ahead. That advert reflects the changing nature of our culture over the last 30, 40, even 50 years. Although, to be honest, what was hidden has just come to the surface, really. Most couples now cohabit before formal marriage. Many couples have children before they are married. That's a practice returning to times before 1600 in our country. The truth is, and perhaps we don't always want to hear this, the truth is that even in the 1950s, half the people getting married in churches in this land were already expecting a child before they got to the altar or the front of the church. That's the truth. There has never been a perfect society for these issues. But divorce is much easier now than it was in the past. 40% of marriages today end in divorce, and that's not counting the more informal relationships that collapse before they get to marriage. Actually, the rate, according to the latest social attitudes trends, the rate is reducing from its peak at about 2008-2010. But divorce is now accepted as part of the relational landscape of our culture. And we live in an age of equal marriage, where it is open to different and the same genders. This is the landscape that we as Christians have to live within and navigate and speak into and sometimes defend ourselves when it speaks to us too. Seems to me the church is often playing catch up with these issues, and it's often seen to be out of step with the cultural trends of the day, and it doesn't lead us to be seen to be offering a very positive view of these things. Too often we are the church of the do not, rather than the church of the do. I often hear, especially of younger generations, I often hear it said, they say, "I like Jesus, but I'm not quite sure about the church." Well, that leads me to wonder what Jesus they have been looking at. Because some of his teaching makes pretty uncomfortable reading. And even those people who were close to him and were learning from them, they found it hard to live with. Relationships can be an ethical quagmire. That was true in Jesus' day, too, as well as ours. The Pharisees, well, they were very devout in wanting to do right by God. They wanted to honour God. They were one of these different religious groups in the society of Jesus' day. And they wanted to honour God by being obedient to the law that they found in the Old Testament, the rules and the regulations that God had given through Moses, which had shaped their life for perhaps 1,000 years. So some Pharisees came and tested Jesus. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? Lots of different sections of society came and questioned Jesus with questions that were important for them. One thing that I'm always weary when somebody comes and asks me a question about a controversial subject, actually, in church life, because I'm not quite sure if they really want to discuss it. They just want to see if my answer matches with their answer. And then they feel okay about me and about them. But of course, if it doesn't, they don't. And as ministers, I, along with most of my colleagues, have found myself on the end of the judgmental attitude because we have not given the right answer or at times a biblical answer. And that's what was happening to Jesus here when people came to test him. Test him and trap him. But this is a strange question that they come to ask him about divorce, because he wasn't that controversial. Divorce was part of the fabric of their society. It happened. It was allowed. So why ask him this question? Next week, John's going to preach next week. He asks him a question about money and taxes. Who they should they pay the money to the Roman Emperor? That is a controversial question. This, does Moses allow divorce? That, not so controversial in their setting. No, it was a long-standing part of culture. There were rules in the Old Testament about divorce. In fact, the practice of divorce predated those rules in the Old Testament. There is nowhere in the Old Testament where it says God allows a man to divorce his wife. The main teaching in Deuteronomy 24 says, when a man divorces his wife, it's just accepted. Men are allowed to divorce their wives. The rules there are meant to limit the damage and the abuse of that practice. But the interpretation of what those laws and rules in the Old Testament meant, that was controversial. And in a couple of centuries before Jesus, there had been two interpretations of how this law should be applied. There was one school which followed this Rabbi Shammah, who actually said the only grounds for a man divorcing his wife was adultery. And probably what he really meant, that when they got married, she wasn't a virgin. And he could divorce her on that grounds. On the other end of the spectrum, there was Rabbi Hittel, who took a slightly broader view of the matter, who said that anything that displeases a husband, from his wife's looks, to her bad cooking, to her poor and shabby dress sense, they were grounds for divorce. Even if you saw a woman you liked better than your wife, that was fine. It was grounds to divorce your wife. Guess which view was more popular in Jesus' day? We are not the first age of the quickie and easy divorce. And the consequences were huge. The consequences were huge. Jesus' day, and through most of human history, and in many cultures around the world today, they are cultures of unequal marriage. Unequal marriage. A man could and can divorce his wife. A wife could not divorce her husband. She either had to endure in a bad marriage, or she could be thrown away, disposed of. And if her family didn't take her back in, then she was abandoned and in poverty and struggling to make a living for herself and maybe for her family. That's the context in which this question is being asked. And yet, it's not only an ethical question that the Pharisees are asking Jesus. There's a political edge to it too. Just like today, relationships are a political football, there were in that day too. There was a very high-profile celebrity case present in Jesus' day where a woman had divorced her husband and got remarried. It wasn't allowed under Jewish law, but it was allowed under Roman law, and the Romans were a judge. Herodias had divorced her husband to marry her brother-in-law, King Herod. It caused a minor war between Herod and his brother Philip, which the Romans had to intervene on. This was a really hot potato at the heart of their nation. John the Baptist had criticised Herod and said, it's not lawful for you to marry your brother-in-law's wife. That's what the law said in the Old Testament. John had criticised Herod for that and got himself arrested. And Herodias had manipulated Herod into chopping his head off. This was a dangerous political question. And perhaps here is an opportunity for Jesus to end up in the same boat, to be similarly condemned. Or maybe the Pharisees, more positively, were looking for an opportunity to push Jesus to declare himself king against Herod. Well, as with all these questions that Jesus gets asked, he is wise enough not to fall into either trap. And he doesn't really answer them publicly with regard to this political issue they all know is around, but on his own with his disciples. When they come to him and say, are you sure about this stuff you're saying about divorce? Because, you know, it seems a bit hard. In fact, in one of the other Gospels, it said they came to Jesus and said, look, If that's what God wants about our married relationship, it's better enough not to get married in the first place. You know, privately, commenting to his disciples, he says those last two verses. When a man who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another man, she commits adultery. See, at the heart of their national life, at the very centre of power, is this relationship which just clashes and is against one of the core rules that God gave them. Do not commit adultery. Jesus is asked a loaded question, ethically and politically, about God's rules for marriage and relationships. What is right and what is wrong? Too often that's how we think. We like the certainty of rules. We like the black and whiteness of them. But you don't have to be a pastor or a minister to know that life is messy and broken, and at times grey. Jesus actually turns the focus around. He turns the focus from rules about getting out of marriage to actually principles that marriage expresses, based upon God's design and action in creation. And maybe in an age of fragile and broken and hurting relationships and a changing understanding of how these things have worked out, perhaps that's the place to begin with Jesus. The two will become one flesh. The two will become one flesh. Jesus draws upon those creation narratives. But if you read the rest of the New Testament writing and go into Paul, there's an understanding there that that phrase one flesh, is enacted and expressed in the actual sexual intimacy between people. It stresses sexual faithfulness within marriage, unfaithfulness breaks the bonds and tears one flesh apart. It's hard to rebuild a marriage after that. But more widely, this idea of one flesh counters this unequal marriage that existed in their society and has existed in so many eras of our society too, where one partner, the man in Jesus' culture and so often in our culture, dominates. I also find it interesting when you read in the creation stories about this passage about leaving father and mother that Jesus quotes. It's the wrong way round. Seems to be the wrong way round. Because it doesn't say a wife will leave her father and mother and be united to her husband. That, to me, always seems the way it should be if women are so often seen as property to be passed on in negotiations. And that's what the ancient societies often saw of women. No, it says the man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife. It seems to me that even in that one sentence, it describes an equality, a mutual sharing within marriage, one to another. The second most important commandment, Jesus says, is love your neighbour as yourself. I think God's design for marriage goes to the extreme of this. One flesh speaks of a deep interconnection, a mutual trust, an enriching, an affirming, a giving up oneself for the sake of the other. A reflection between two individuals of what God intends for our Christian community. Even the New Testament picture of how the church relates to Jesus. We are the bride of Christ. What God has joined together, Jesus says, let no one separate. This is a unity beyond emotions and feelings. When we marry somebody in church, we do not say to them, do you love so-and-so? We don't say that. We don't ask that question. Do you love? We say, we ask, will you love? Will you love? See, living out this pattern of God's intention for us takes more than some mushy thing that we call love in our society. Living out this passion takes active will and desire. It takes effort. To be honest, it's flipping hard work at times. You know, if you're laughing now, you know that. You know that. It's an act of will at times, and commitment, and prayer, and trust. And I've seen it worked out in good, long-lasting marriages. And to be honest, I've seen it worked out in some people who are not formally married either. Sometimes better than amongst people who are formally married. And I've seen when it becomes broken in both too. In response to the Pharisees' question about divorce, Jesus said, well, actually, this is not God's intention for our living together. He gave you this command, Moses, because your hearts were hardened. Your hearts were hardened. When our will is focused on ourself and not the other. When our desire is to live our way and not according to God's pattern for us. And it results in pain and broken trust. It can result in guilt and crushing disappointment. It can undermine our value and our identity. It can alienate us from others. Can separate us from community, even from ourselves, and it can push us away from God and destroy faith. And we can try, and we can hope, and we can pray, and we can work with people towards reconciliation. But sometimes the pain is too deep. The scars are too raw. The one flesh is ripped apart. And it's hard to put things back together. If not impossible. Sometimes the pain and the separation of divorce is less painful than the staying together. And even though it's less than God's intention for us, it might be the best thing. This is less than God would want, as it is in any of our relationships which are broken. But Jesus knew the pain of alienation too, but the brokenness of life. As he hung on the cross, he quotes Psalm 22. Which have been the words of many people in life. My God, why have you forsaken me? There are many people who feel forsaken because of brokenness in a relationship, because they have been abused. Not treated well, been put to one side. Jesus knows that pain, for he was set aside and moved from the intimacy of shared life with God to a deep sake of forsakenness from that which he was a part of. And yet from this moment, sharing our brokenness, we are joined to God, who seeks our wholeness and our healing. As Paul says in Romans 8, nothing can separate us from the love of God, not even broken relationships. And divorce. because what God has joined together through the cross, nothing and no one can separate.